Just take your time getting ready, getting settled in. This is our last matter for the oral argument portion of our calendar for today. As I mentioned, it is case number A18-0922, Dobson versus Soley. The only party here is the party representing appellant Ryan Leon Soley, is my understanding, correct? And so you will have 15 minutes for your argument because respondent's not here. We will not hear from respondent, and you won't get your 5 minutes for rebuttal. That'll be a part of your 15-minute total argument. When you're ready, feel free to approach the podium, state your name for the record and the party you're representing, and then you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Jason Steck. I represent the appellant Ryan Soley in this matter. This case involves the interaction between the Minnesota Domestic Abuse Act and the constitutional requirement for due process of law. This court has often observed that the Minnesota Domestic Abuse Act is a remedial statute, and its intention is to protect individuals who either are victims or fear that they may become victims of domestic violence. But it nonetheless has very significant effects on individuals who are the subject, whose conduct is limited by orders for protection. And thus, it has to be limited by the requirements that they receive due process. But what does that mean? I would argue that the right to a fair and impartial hearing is the core component of due process of law. And that contains at least two components. First, the right to submit evidence on one's own behalf. And second, the right to have that evidence and supporting arguments actually considered by the court. Put another way, a district court has discretion and broad discretion on whether to grant an order for protection, but this involves the use of sober judgment after due consideration of all relevant evidence. It's distinct from the mere imposition of a judge's will or preference. The judge has to consider the evidence, not just what the judge would like to see happen, or what the judge would cherry pick from the evidence available. Both of these elements of due process were violated by the district court and denied to Mr. Soley. First, Mr. Soley was denied the right to submit evidence. The district court based its grant of an order for protection in large part, on the finding that Mr. Soley had, quote, broken into Ms. Dobson's house. Mr. Soley sought on several occasions, including as an offer of proof post-trial, to submit video evidence that would show he used a key to enter the house. He didn't break into anything.
Well, counsel, Mr. Soley didn't have the right to possess the house. Is that correct?
Your Honor.
Under the divorce decree.
Let me restate that.
Ms. Dobson had the right to possession under the divorce decree.
She had the right to possession, but that does not involve, she did not have exclusive right to possession or exclusive right to the house.
Is there anything in the divorce decree that indicates affirmatively or specifically that Mr. Soley has the right to enter the house?
He remained a tenant in common, which meant he had a property interest in the house. Since he had learned that the utilities had been turned off, and since this house is in northern Minnesota, that it raises a concern about waste. It raises a concern about damage to the house. As a tenant in common, he had the right, especially after he learned that the utilities had been turned off and that Ms. Dobson no longer resided at the house, to check on the condition of the house. It wasn't like he was trying to possess the house. He wasn't trying to, he was entering to check the condition of the house.
Then he changed the locks, though, didn't he?
No, Your Honor, he did not.
Okay.
He used the key that he had possessed prior to the house, moving out of the house in the first place. It was the original key. It was the original locks. So there was no changing of the locks. I know the district court asked some questions about the changing of the locks, but there is never any changing of the locks. But importantly here, he attempted to, even if the district court was finding that this wasn't credible or had some concerns about the credibility, the district court at least had the obligation to view, accept, and consider the evidence that Mr. Soley was trying to produce. At a minimum, even if the district court ultimately had decided not to believe the evidence or to believe that the locks had been changed, It cannot be argued that the video evidence that Mr. Soli was trying to submit to the court wasn't relevant to that question. It showed him using a key. He didn't break into anything. It's relevant to the district court's finding.
But the court didn't even find one way or another about this key or how he got in. I mean, if I'm reading what the court said at the hearing, he said, it's terrifying the fact that you would go into the house after the recent expiration of an OFP and then change the locks. Apparently, he did feel like he went in the house and just took it over, apparently. That was the essence for his ruling. Not whether he had a key or not. Well, he was there without the permission of his, I assume it's an ex-wife, that he was there without her permission and that he went in and took it over.
Well, the court says at one point, I don't believe you had a key.
Well, the counsel, but that wasn't really the focus of the court's decision. It was more that he went in without her, you know, she had possession and of the home. He did not have possession of the home, and so it was a violation of her rights for him to enter, and it caused fear, and I think the court even used the word possibly stronger words than that. But so I don't think that, I think the court was more focused on the effect on Ms. Dobson and with her being in possession of the home and him not being in possession of the home, that she was the one who had sole possession of the home. But one other point, I think you said that Mr. Soli did not change the locks. On page 52 of the transcript, he says, yes, I changed the locks. So he specifically told the court that he changed the locks.
I perhaps may have misstated the record with regard to changing the locks. I was focusing on the issue that he didn't break in.
Right, and the district court did find that in the order on item number 4. It says, on 4/3/18, respondent broke into petitioner's residence and changed the locks, preventing petitioner from returning to her home. I know it's late in the day, but I thank you for that, because I was thinking I was on a completely different case, but go ahead.
But if, as I see it right now, I've got two questions pending, and
I'm sorry, I shouldn't set the lock comment aside for a later question, but the more pertinent question, I think, is the basis for the OFP and whether Ms. Dobson had a reasonable basis for fear, and given that she was in sole possession of the home and hadn't authorized him to be in the home, didn't the court have a reasonable basis to conclude that she feared for her safety?
No, Your Honor.
Especially given the past history of domestic abuse that was found.
No, Your Honor, because I'd like to question the premise there. And this is exactly goes to what the relevance of the video evidence would have been. Ms. Dobson testified that his act of entering the home put her in fear, or as the court said, it was an act of terror. Okay. Her statement, then, is a statement that's subject to a credibility determination. Is she actually in fear? Well, if she doesn't actually live there, then her statement has some questions about its credibility, because she's not there. There's no basis for his entry to the home to cause her fear if she doesn't actually live there. The video evidence would have shown that upon entering the home, it was empty. There's no evidence that anybody was living there.
There was other testimony to that effect in the record already, so what would the video evidence add that wasn't already in the record?
Well, because that evidence was the district court was raising questions about that. Well, maybe there were some things in there. You said there were some chairs in there. So obviously, you know, there's somebody living there. The video evidence would have resolved this ambiguity of the district court's skepticism, or at least provided an additional piece of relevant evidence that the district court had an obligation to consider. It's a piece of evidence that tends to establish a contested fact. Did Ms. Dobson actually live there or not? To be more or less true. That's the core definition of relevant evidence, and the district court wouldn't even look at it. That goes to her credibility.
As to credibility, don't we defer to the district court?
Well, but the district court has an obligation to consider evidence that's attempted to be submitted that goes to credibility.
So you're saying the judge abused his discretion in not allowing that evidence?
In not allowing Mr. Soli to submit relevant evidence that related to credibility. It simply assumed she was credible and then denied him the right to rebut that or to challenge that credibility.
Well, whether or not she was actually living there, if she had the right to sole possession of the home and he enters without her permission, doesn't that still create grounds for fear?
Your Honor, that slightly but importantly mischaracterizes what the provision in the dissolution decree was. It did not provide that Ms. Dobson had sole possession of the home. It simply said she had possession of the home. It also provided that he remained a tenant in common in the home, which means that he still has a property interest in the home and an interest in ensuring that it is not subject to waste.
But the decree did not allow him to have possession.
It didn't allow him to have possession, but it allowed him to retain his property interest in the home.
But having property interest in a residence is a lot different than having possession.
Yes, Your Honor. But she also, at that point, had abandoned her possession of the home. She didn't live there.
Were there any clothes? Were her clothes
no.
there? Why is it that the petition indicates that he took her clothes out of the
I don't recall there being that there were clothes in there in the home. And again, this is an issue that the video evidence would have addressed. If the district court had looked at the video evidence, we could have established whether there were clothes in the home. I don't believe that there was any evidence on the video that there were clothes in the home. The petition may have stated there were clothes on the home.
Correct.
If that's the case, once again, the video evidence is relevant to establish the credibility of statements made in the petition.
But isn't the petition made under oath?
Yes, it's testimony, but he has the right to challenge the credibility of that testimony.
Did your client contact, I know there was a prior OFP that expired, I believe, 2 days before your client entered the home. Is that correct?
Yes.
Did your client try to contact Ms. Dobson prior to entering the home?
I don't believe he did. I believe that he was, given the circumstances that and Ms. Dobson's testimony, that certainly would have been construed as something he shouldn't have done.
Phrased in a manner, I'm concerned about the pipes, I'm concerned about the property, would it be okay if I go in the house to address those issues?
And is that something he could have done? Maybe. I would say, though, that's certainly not something he's obligated to do. He went and got the chief of police
for the
town.
But the question here is whether there was a reasonable basis for finding that she feared for her safety. And so isn't that relevant? You say he didn't have an obligation to do so, but the circumstances under which he entered the home, isn't that relevant?
Yes, and I would say that those circumstances are protected in another way. He went and got the chief of police to accompany him. I don't see how the circumstances could be.
Did the chief of police attempt to contact Ms. Dobson before entering?
I don't know. I think that there was some communication because the chief of police Chief Gazelka was passing on information about the fact that she didn't live there. So I guess that there was probably some awareness from the chief of police that Mrs. Dobson didn't live there, but I don't know that he spoke to her directly.
There's no affirmative evidence that he that the chief contacted
no.
Ms. Dobson.
The question, though, here is whether or not the subsequent OFP or the statement of the reasonableness of a fear obligates Mr. Soli to take this alternative measure of contacting her in advance. Because, Your Honor, if we're going to play out this sort of what might have been if he had done that, what's to say that she wouldn't have said that his attempt to contact her also put her in fear, thus justifying an OFP? I mean, that's a double-edged sword. His attempt to contact her could have been taken itself as another thing that put her in fear. This is a catch-22 for Mr. Soli trying to find a way to check on the property. And the due process has got to include, you know, the ability to exercise your legitimate rights, such as the right to protect to check on your property, without putting yourself in a catch-22 where either way you're going to be found wanting, and you're going to be found having been put Ms. Dobson in fear. The additional measure that I'd like to suggest is that the district court betrayed a fairly hostile attitude towards Mr. Soley during the course of the hearing. The district court repeatedly interrupted Mr. Soley, limited what he was his opportunity to present his case, and importantly, made two monologues addressing his status as a police officer, saying, essentially, I'm holding you to a higher standard because you're a police officer. Also making some negative comments about how police officers all the time find ways to get around OFPs. In short, the district court betrayed a bias against Mr. Soley because of his background as a police officer.
Well, didn't that really go to his credibility? Because the district court was questioning him. He testified differently than what she did. In other words, he testified, for instance, with respect to the locks. She testified she changed the locks. He testified, no, the locks weren't changed. I just used the old key I had. So there was a credibility determination, and the fact that he's a police officer and knows how to enter buildings, doesn't that really go to that? And then the second question I have is that he did testify that he did not have a right to enter that house, didn't he?
He agreed he didn't have a right to possess the house. He agreed with the district court's characterization.
No, I believe he testified that he did not have a right to enter the house.
Your Honor, I would note that that was a question that had been coming from the district court. I would say that it's not fair to Mr. Soley to parse it to that degree. At that time, the district court had already been asking him hostile questions. He was attempting to mollify the judge, you know, by agreeing, yes, I understand what you're telling me, Your Honor. I don't think that that constitutes an admission that he understood that in some legal sense.
So a question by the district court judge of a witness, you want us to ignore that he said he did not have a right to enter that house?
I think what he was saying there, if you look at it in context, Your Honor, is that he was agreeing that the divorce decree prevented him from possessing the house. I don't think he was saying I had no right to enter the house. He was agreeing that the district court...
We'll definitely look at that testimony.
Is there any further questions? My time's expired, so.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. We appreciate your arguments and your briefing. We will issue an opinion on the order within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you. That is our last case on our oral calendar for today. With that, court is adjourned.